I mean, Vilsack oversaw the death of the hog family farmer as governor of Iowa, and then he oversaw the death of the dairy family farmer as, secretary of agriculture. And it's just like, I'm over being polite of like, oh, everyone kind of rolls their eyes when he talks about his solutions. It's like, no, you are, my grandkids are going to pay for your consequences. Like that is what really bothers me. It's like your inability to do anything because you want to probably be a lobbyist again, because you already were a lobbyist before, is like really detrimental to everyone. Because your personal greed, it's just the air of rampant selfishness. It's just like really what bothers me here.
Welcome to the Real Organic Podcast. I'm Lindley Dixon, co-director of the Real Organic Project. We're a grassroots, farmer-led movement with an add-on organic food label to distinguish organic crops grown in healthy soils and organic livestock raised on well-managed pasture. You just heard from Austin Frerich. He's the author of the book Barrens: Money, Power, and the Corruption of the World's Food Industry. This is available to buy from your local bookstores starting today. Austin is with the Thurman Arnold Center at Yale University, and I had to look that one up. It's an antitrust center. So his book, Barrens, is about seven families who've come to dominate aspects of the food system to the point where their consolidated power has completely changed their industries, and that's been to the detriment of food system workers, the environment, Main Street America, and our democracy. So one of my aha moments in reading Frerich's book is that deregulation and a failure to enforce antitrust has resulted in such highly consolidated monopolistic markets. And that inevitably leads to a loss in our democracy because these individuals not only have money and power, but they use that to influence policies to favor them. It's a situation where these entities are so big that they can set prices and have essentially become too big to fail because the system comes to depend on them to keep shelf space stocked. The level to which our systems have incentivized this consolidation to the demise of family farming across the country is heartbreaking, and it's much of why the Real Organic Project exists. I was fortunate to be sent a pre-released version of the book from this first-time author and was so blown away that I decided to interview him for our symposium, Break 'em Up, The Chickenization of Organic. Tickets are still available to join us live for the second session, which will air on April 7th, and you will also gain access to the recording of session one of the symposium, which aired on March 17th. So visit our website, realorganicproject.org, to watch the preview and to find out all of the details to join us. We had a lively breakout session in the first session, so we hope you join us.
Okay, great. I am so pleased today to welcome Austin Frerich to the Real Organic Podcast. He's the author of the upcoming book, Barrens: Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. I was really lucky to get an early copy of it. And I wanted to start with the fact that you decided to concentrate on, well, the introduction of these complex topics, really, on focusing on the people behind it, which might be a little controversial. I mean, it's a little personal. You say really it's the story of these seven families. And so I'm wondering why you chose to write about the people and not just the businesses.
Yeah. To me, the people, the reason why I chose the people were we live it like these. I love the notion of using robber barons as a frame, because to me, I'm hearkening back to a previous moment in American history, but also that phrase implies that these people, mostly men, can shape industries. And I believe the degree of power that they now wield in these different spaces, we need to focus in on that, because that is what's shaping the American food system is. We know a lot of good people out there trying to push certain reforms, but a few greedy people are holding us back.
Yeah, and you said that they were willing to cross lines that others wouldn't. And so
yeah.
this is really a book about morality.
100%. That is like what something I realized with the robber baron is they're willing to go to ethical degree places and most people won't go. Most people won't put their animals packed into a metal shed.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there were 36,000 cows in your chapter on dairy in that one business.
On my dairy baron.
Yes. So I actually thought it would be good to just even define monopoly, because I feel like some people think that, well, if Amazon and Walmart both sell groceries, you know, you could kind of go into detail of those two, then there's competition, right? If just a few players are battling it out, then you don't really have a monopoly. So maybe just go ahead and explain what a monopoly is and why, if you just have a few players competing with each other, that actually is still a monopoly.
Yeah, I generally use a broader definition of monopoly, just market dominance, where you have so much market power, you can shape the market. This is like the nerd in me, but like even how you define a market is such a political question. For example, Walmart is my grocery baron. Walmart sells 1 in 3 groceries nationwide. Their market share is the same as the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th combined. But you're not gonna, why are we talking about national market share for grocery? Like if you live in Milwaukee, you're not, you know what I mean? It doesn't matter what's going on in Raleigh. So when you actually look at metropolitan market shares, I mean, Walmart, I have this stat somewhere in the book, but a lot of major metropolitans in America, Walmart will have 75, 85% market share. Same thing with hogs. Like, I don't care what national market shares are in hogs, because you're not gonna take a hog from Iowa and butcher it in South Carolina. So to me, even the act of defining a market is political, but monopoly per se is the ability to dominate and shape a marketplace. That is kind of how I view it in a broader sense.
Well, this breaks down a little bit, because I actually remember when we were talking to Zephyr, she was even saying that if you run a small farm in like a local town and you kind of dominate the sale of tomatoes or something like that, then that would even be marketplace domination, because we have so many small farms. Would you agree with that? What would be done in a case?
No,
like
that? No, I don't really. That's not the same power. I mean, when the Walton family is the richest family in the world, a grocery empire we've never seen before, slaughtering baron that has a butchering empire we've never seen before, that is not the same. The influences of these barons shape thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives, millions of lives. This little tomato example, that's just a tomato in a little town. I don't even like the phrase small farmer. I purposely don't have it in my book. I think it's a patronizing term. I really want to make this dichotomy of family farms and corporate, or I kind of use the phrase corporate farms or industrial operations. I love, the Wisconsin Farmers Union has a definition of family farms that I just love. It's most of labor comes from the family. By that definition, no Robert Barron in my book is a farmer, even though most of them in the media will identify themselves as a farmer. I view these people as capital asset managers. So like, I just like, even that phrase small, it's like, to me, it's like the story of agriculture, modern agriculture in America now is a lot of terms defined by industry that are either designed to wall you off so you don't know what they're talking about, or patronize or preciousness or that kind of stuff. I don't know. It's so weird. I want more family farms. That's kind of the goal of my book. I want to put animals on land. The system we have now is just a bunch of industrial operations, a bunch of Wall Street financial types running the system.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I even feel like I could push that definition further, because it might even be a grain centric definition of a farm, because grain doesn't have a lot of human labor. So a lot of like a small vegetable farm, which is a lot of human labor, would have a lot more than just the family doing the labor on the farm. So I would want it to be pushed even further to that. But I think the whole idea is that these people are actually, they have political power, right? So just because you're dominating a local tomato market, you know, which we can talk about ways to kind of, you know, outside of this conversation, you know, whether that's good or bad and how you might want to encourage some other farmers to succeed in your area. But there's no way that I would actually have influence over politics from that market. And I think that's kind of at the core of, like, maybe you can describe a little bit better what we're at risk. I feel like we're at risk of losing our democracy, and it's worse now than it's ever been. So maybe talk about that correlation between a monopoly and the loss of our democracy.
That was a really big point I went into this book wanting to make. And I did it in my Coffee Baron chapter. My Coffee Baron is this secret German family called the Reimann family. The rumor is that even when they turn 18, they sign a pledge not to even make a photo of them public. So if you go to the Forbes richest list, they're one of the richest, I think the richest or second richest family in Germany, you can't find a photo of these people. My favorite little thing about them is they now sell more coffee than Starbucks. And they didn't sell a single bean of coffee in America until 2012. Wow. I have to write this down because it's so many brands. They own, I kid you not, Pete's Coffee, Caribou Coffee, Einstein Brothers Bagels, Brugger's Bagels, Manhattan Bagel, Noah's Bagels, Krispy Kreme, Pret a Manger, Insomnia Cookie, Panera Red, Stumptown, Intelligentsia, Green Mountain Coffee, Trade Coffee, Keurig. Which is just basically any strip mall in America you see a coffee chain, they own a good chunk of them. So I tell the story of this family because this family made its money. They were old German industrialists, chemical industrialists. They were very early supporters of Hitler's regime, of the Nazis. They used slave labor. I really go into detail more about the history of this family and how this company's tried to grapple with its past. And I just, I mean, like, so this was like lost history I discovered in my research, but after World War II, the U.S. Library of Congress commissioned, did some studies in Congress of how did fascists happen? And the big finding they had were monopolists. Mm. Monopolist finance fascists. Hitler's largest donor was IG Farben. IG Farben's broken up. You might have heard one of its companies today, now known as Bayer Monsanto. There is this, you know, fascists love using the rhetoric of the working person, but they're really for the monopolies. So I really want to tell that kind of history. I thought this family, the secret German family, is a good way to tell it. And then also weave in my personal story. My mom had a bakery most of my life growing up in Cedar Rapids. You know, we eventually closed that bakery. My mom ended up working for Starbucks for a long time. You know, the mall where she had her bakery was now ended up being demolished because of Walmart. That's a whole different chapter. But what I end this chapter on, you know, the CEO of this coffee baron family saying, oh, we can't repeat history, we can't do this again. And I, you know, I'm paralleling, dancing around. I don't think I'm even dancing around the lines with Trump right now, to be frank with you. Is you see a strong man tap into a lot of forgotten communities. But even though he has rhetoric of the working man, he's for the robber barons. But my point there is we live in, like, that's a really scary place to be in, is when you have people that write checks this big. We have the campaign finance system that's been deregulated, collapsed. The news, I mean, the state of American media right now is, you know, all the ad media was taken up by two, you know, Google and Facebook. It's scary. It's very scary. I mean, I don't know how else to say that to people. I mean, the hardest thing I have with this book is, how do I have an honest conversation with the food system, but not overwhelm you? And that is, like, honestly something I really had to struggle with as I wrote this book.
Well, I think the most touching thing was that you actually wove that personal story of your mother's coffee shop and your vacations driving through the Driftless region of Wisconsin, where because of the topography, there's a lot of organic farms there, right? The farms are smaller. And it's been so devastating for the organic community to witness sort of the flourishing of the small farm under the organic label and then the taking away of it because what's happened in organic, there's been consolidation. It's the same thing that happened to the family farmers under, you know, chemical agriculture. Yeah. I wonder, have you been following at all any of what's happened in organic being, you know, from Wisconsin, the dairies there? I think they were like at one point, and this was probably 5 years ago, maybe seven. Actually, I think at the time there were only four certified organic dairies in Texas, and they outcompeted. They outproduced milk by the 456 organic dairy farms in Wisconsin. And that number, I mean, I think now we're up to 11, and like the number of organic family dairies in Wisconsin has gone way down too. So I'm just curious if you've kind of been following at all what's been happening in organic. And of course, I mean, you have a chapter on dairy in this, and you also have a chapter on Driscoll's, which has also been a huge problem in organic.
That is just to kind of bounce around.
Yeah.
Connect both that question and my mom's coffee shop. So
I know,
much.
I'm sorry, I put a lot into one question.
No. But that's like the beauty. Like, what I had so much fun writing this book is it's all interconnected.
Yes.
So how do I kind of tease them out? Like, there's so many other ways they can go with these different barons, but like Cargill's just about Farm Bill. But going back to my mom's coffee shop, like what I realized working at my mom's like any child of a small business owner, I worked at a lot as a child, is the dignity, how much pride my mom had in her business, but also the relationships she built with people. We're selling coffee in Iowa. Coffee is not There's no coffee grown in Iowa. You know what I mean? In the day, it's a bean. So you see the relationships. You see the sense of community. And like my mom would, you know, put little special, like for the holidays, do little things, work with other vendors nearby, do little cool things. And then you see, I just remember when she was working at Starbucks, Starbucks would tell her, it just didn't trust her. There was no, it was stripping her of the dignity of like, you got to put this item here on this shelf. This shelf has to be arranged this way. We don't trust you as a professional, as someone doing this for a living, to make these judgment calls. Mm. It's just like everything's coming out of Seattle, top down. And to me, you see that kind of in organic and dairy, where I worked on this for 5 years, and I've been so fortunate. So many people let me into their home. I had conversations around table. They took me to your farm, what have you. And I just remember I toured an organic dairy up in the Adirondacks. And you just realize this farmer had a relationship with our cows. She knew their personalities. She kind of knew their names. There's a sense of pride, dignity, but also just compassion. You are taking from the animal, but you're also giving to the animal. You're caring for the animal. When you have 35,000 cows, that's all gone. Yeah. You don't even know your workers. You have hundreds of workers. You are running a feudal plantation at that point. Those cows are just numbers in an Excel sheet. Nothing more, nothing less. And it's just, I mean, that to me is like the story of the American economy right now. It's like this cult of efficiency, the degradation of human values, of what makes living living. And I mean, the funny thing about even this cult of efficiency, it's mostly BS. I mean, numbers lie. I can make any number say what I want. I mean, but I talk about my coffee chapter is a little bit history of monopoly in America. And how many hogs one person should own? There's no math formula to tell us that. That is a moral question we need to wrestle with as a society. Yet for some reason, we moved to this model of monopoly where companies can merge so long as these economists that they hire show that prices will go down for consumers. Well, I can find any economist to give me those numbers. You know, it's this pseudoscience we use to mask these moral judgments. And I just think that this system, it's run itself into the ground. I think a lot of people feel it. It's not working anymore for many people.
Yeah, you actually do a good job at showing that, you know, once they're able to dominate the market, that those prices go right back up. And what we're hearing from farmers right now, I mean, the Real Organic Project has 1,100 farmers that are under the seal. And so we communicate with them a lot. And prices are up in the grocery stores, and they are either level or have gone down for the farmers. And so they're like, are we overproducing? They're like, what is going on here? And it's looking like it's the work of not a free economy anymore. And yeah. I'm wondering if you can kind of, it seems counterintuitive maybe, like, to not actually interfere, this whole laissez-faire, you know, economy that we actually need some policies to create it so that maybe you can explain like why we actually need influence from the government in order to create a more fair economy, that we actually don't have that right now by doing nothing.
We have a mafioso system like that. That's, I find that whole phrase laissez-faire funny, because it's like, we have one that I call the modern farm bill, the Wall Street farm bill. It's one of the most expensive farm bills, but it's really just benefiting a few. Mm. And I mean, the joke I make all the time is the only farmer really operating on free market is honestly mostly a lot of your members. A lot of farmers, you know, they're not getting the massive government payment programs that if I'm in a industrial conventional corn farmer would get, because the system is designed to overproduce commodity grains non-organically. That's what Wall Street wants. Pepsi wants to pay the least amount possible to make chips and pop. Monsanto wants to sell as much chemicals as possible. Cargill, my grain baron, wants to process, transport as many grains as possible. It doesn't care. It doesn't want you to grow carrots. Then on top of it, this whole system is anything that's labor intensive is being shipped offshore. That's where I really tried. I mean, that's where my Driscoll chapter really came in. I mean, that whole chapter came because, I kid you not, I read in the Christian Science Monitor an article like 5-10 years ago where 70% of apple juice in America is coming from China, which blows my mind, because you can grow apples anywhere. Most of the lower 48 states. And like, my grandpa had an orchard when I was little. Like, I love apples. And I realized quickly, oh, like the biggest cost for apple production is labor. So, oh, that's why it's in China, where it somehow it's cheaper to ship a liquid across the world than it is to do it here. And I just heard stories when you go to these different conventions of a lot of apple orchard people walked away. It's just too expensive. They can't compete. And what you realize is these systems, I know I'm using my hands and this is a podcast, so I'll try not to do that. But these they're not even competing fairly. Is the as Bar what happened, what robber barons do is they take their economic power and they use it to corrupt the political system to benefit, to enrich and entrench their business model. And I had such an aha moment a few years ago. I was sitting in a business school class at Yale, and I realized, oh, the goal of any corporate executive is monopoly. That's where profits are. So you have this fundamental tension between government wanting competitive markets because that's good for the economy, that's good for innovation, that's good for workers, and businesses not. Their goal is monopoly. So this is a tension. Like you can't. The story of this era, of this neoliberal era, is winners take all, which is just a blatant lie. And you need competition protection to maintain marketplaces so they can be competitive, or else you'll see robber barons capture the market and break the market.
Yeah, you were even talking about how many times the government has ended up paying for Walmart to, either get really low interest loans or even the SNAP dollars in the like 26 billion or something went back to them. Is that figure correct? So just how many times our government is actually paying out, really large sums of money to these
Well, that's
entities.
why, you think when you say government, like I didn't want to write a book complaining. Like at the very end, I want to be like, here's where things are. Here's where we should go from here. Like here, based on all the time I spent in it. And when you say government, what we really do is talking to you about USDA. I really think we need to have a honest conversation over USDA. I'm almost at the point of stripping it for parts. I just think it's too captured. I think what I've seen a lot in this space, a lot of reformers, is people think you can work with it. Oh, you see, like a lot of the Vilsack. I mean, Vilsack's just a dairy lobbyist. That's all he cares about. They'll tell you what you want to hear, but then they'll just not do anything, or they'll get like, here's a little token program. I just think this agency, the revolving door between checkoffs, Big Ag, USDA. I mean, we've seen with labeling, especially in the organic space. Is something starts off with good intentions and industry captures it. I think we should strip it for parts, or honestly, at this point too, is imagine, like, I was just listening, re-listening to your interview with Francis Dickey, or his talk, I should say. France was one of those people I met early on in my career that really shaped me. He invited me down to his dairy, and I just remember he said to me, he was giving me a tour of his farm, was he views himself as a grass farmer. How the inputs matter so much for his cows. And like his milk's famous in Eastern Iowa. It's like kind of orangey. It's so rich. And imagine if Francis was the undersecretary for agriculture for research. You know what I mean? Why do we keep having these Pepsi lobbyists, DC? Like Francis knows so much. And like I would love nothing more than people in real, like people in this organization to get positions of power. That's what we should be fighting for now, is we're not going to teach Vilsack to do the right thing. He's never shown that in his career. If there's any takeaway from this book is things don't change. Structures change when you change structures and when you change people. And to me, one of the biggest hopes we can take in this space is look what happened with the appointment of Commissioner Khan at the FTC. That's huge. That is such, I mean, you're having the Federal Trade Commission bring monopoly cases against big tech. And that's because of a lot of people in that space really worked really hard to help put her in a position of power, and she's done an incredible job. Sorry, that's kind of a ramble.
Yeah, no, like you said, it's all connected. First of all, Francis Tickey would take that job. He's, not only a PhD soil scientist, but he's been a dairy farmer for I don't know, maybe 30, 40 years. I think that's his dairy's only 80 cows, and yet he's been able to like survive and make a living because he direct markets under his own label. Actually was going to ask a question about the FTC because that's where he went, but there's so many places for this to go. While I'm thinking of it now, what's to me, I think the core of the problem is just an utter loss of transparency. And you go into, I think you did it with peanut butter. You do it with several things where it's like you think you have choice in the marketplace, but it's just this illusion of choice because the same people own all these different brands and really you're just selecting your preferred price point. And if we actually had transparency behind all of this stuff, like where are the farms that this stuff is coming from? How are they treating their workers, right? You can't look into anything if you don't, if it's all, if the book's closed, right? It's all behind closed doors. So how do we get that back? If we just had transparency, then we really could actually act as, you know, we always say, go, you know, purchase, you know, with your dollars, you know, things that match your values. But we can't do that because there's no transparency in the marketplace anymore.
Yeah. Real quick before that, I just want just to add one more thing to Francis that I think about all the time. Lost in this whole conversation, the modern American food system, is the degradation or a collapse of taste. When I've been doing little readings on my dairy chapter for the last few years, I've been doing little milk tastings. I do like conventional milk, pasture milk, and I'll do my Dairy Barons milk Fairlife. And I just kind of like to see what people say. And it's you know, the hands down winner is people love the pasture. There's a creaminess, there's a richness, even though it's all 2%, it's all the same. I do it with bacon. It's just that, I mean, that's been so lost in this cult of efficiency, this corporatization, this industrialization, is that when a berry is from Chile, you know, Driscoll's is not engineering a berry for taste. It's engineering for transportation. So, you know, berry can be picked and sent to Walmarts across America, whereas anyone who's grown a strawberry in the backyard knows the taste difference. So the question of transparency, to me, the key thing with transparency, it has to be coupled with structural reform. Because like the whole notion of like, I mean, I love that little peanut butter analogy. And part of it is my dad, my grandpa were in the beer business. They were beer distributors. So I grew up merchandising that kind of world. And like, I always knew, my dad would always tell me, you know, my dad did gas stations in town. My grandpa did grocery stores. And, you know, he picked me up from school and he had to go fill an order. So I go with him. And he always tell me, oh, this is the upbeat part of town. They like Blue Moon, that kind of thing. So, it's something I'm always been aware of because I grew up in that world and from my mom too. And I love using the peanut butter analogy is because, you know, everyone talks about big tech and all that. And it's like the fact that one company has more than a 50% market share in peanut butter, it's like both cartoonish, but also shows you how broken the system is. Because even that figure in 50% is probably way under, it's probably much higher because a lot of these companies make the store brand. And I list a few store brands they make, and the only reason why I know that is because of recalls on food. But going back to transparency, it's just, you want truth and labeling to matter so it can flourish, so consumers can make the right choice. But choice is not enough to overcome structures. I mean, that is the whole, my personal consumption will not drive structural reform. Like, that is something inherent in me I've realized in the last few decades. And one of the things I talk about in my book is, I'm at the point now, when we talk about the Farm Bill, just the farm programs, not the food assistance programs, I think we should end it. I think maybe take all that money, put it in either conservation or what have you, like crop insurance, commodity programs. They're just too rotten. I mean, the fact that you have the conservation program that comes out of the Dust Bowl is now used to finance hog manure pits.
Yeah,
that's where we are. And yeah. So there's so much issues with transparency that it's so rampant and like it's so corrupted in this space that, and also on top of it, I don't want to put too much on consumers just because most people are working 9-to-5 hard job. And it's just like, I shouldn't put it on them to figure out if their milk is good or not, or if the label organic is good or not. I mean, that's a sad part here is like the story here is US, you kind of see this thread throughout each bearing, is a failure of USDA at every point to stop this race to the bottom.
Yeah. You know, even if it were on the consumer, we don't even have the choice for a good tasting berry or good tasting milk, right? That choice just no longer exists. So it's not like we could do it ourselves anyway.
True, but there are, what I always go back to is there's a lot of, I really, at the end of the day, think most people are good people. And there's a lot of people out there doing really good things. They're barely getting by. I mean, they'll tell you maybe off the record, behind the scenes, you know, it's a struggle. They're barely like the finance. I can tell you about the finances of the book. They're not great. But I just, like, to me, we're living in another gilded age. And it was that last gilded age that ushered in a progressive movement. That's the hope I have right now. And, like, as weird as it sounds, I think a silver lining is the movement of cars to EVs because it's going to kill ethanol. And I think that's the best thing to happen to the Corn Belt. Is what are you going to do with when you don't need half the corn crop anymore? And I mean, I'm crossing my fingers, lighting my prayer candles that we can put animals back on the pasture.
I wondered if you could talk a little bit about this whole, like, because you're talking about what can the common person do? And it's like, well, I'm just shopping for cheap prices. And I don't really care so much about all of this stuff that, you know what I mean, seems a little bit out of my control. And what I do want is for things to be affordable. And there were two kind of historians. I didn't know much about this, and maybe other people do, but I was wondering if you could kind of talk about the difference between Bork and Brandeis, even though I know they weren't of the same time. But for me, they seemed like two people to remember because they really had a different view of what a competitive market should look like. And it seems like Bork was able to really influence politics. I think you said he was going to be nominated for the Supreme Court. And fortunately, he didn't get there, but he was still really able, maybe under Reagan, to change policy so that really we changed the way we look at monopolies in terms of only the effect on consumers and prices, instead of the power that, you know, monopolies can have in terms of taking over democracy and all the other issues. So maybe talk a little bit about Bork and Brandeis and what lessons we can learn from them.
Yeah, I mean, to me, Bork and Brandeis, I try to make them, this is the writer in me. So much of what I do is I consume a lot of information and I want to distill things in a way to understand. And I want to create a dichotomy here of power. How do we conceptualize power in America? And Brandeis is, you know, he was, comes out of Louisville, Kentucky, was a lawyer in Boston, and he really cut his teeth fighting a railroad monopoly in New England. What he saw were, there was all these promises, but what he saw were shenanigans, corners being cut, politicians being bribed. Years later comes out, after tragic accidents, he was proven right. President Wilson nominated him to the Supreme Court. Until Merrick Garland, he was the longest delayed confirmation hearing for a Supreme Court judge. And his whole thing was he fundamentally believed concentrated economic power corrupts the political system. He had a very holistic view of power, especially power that is achieved through non-organic growth, through, you know, acquisition after acquisition. Someone like McCoffee Baron, that would be something he would despise because it's not, you know, my secret German family was in the coffee business. They were in the perfume business. And just because they have a massive pool of money, they're able to all of a sudden take over an industry.
Right.
So Brandeis really feared that. Someone like Robert Bork, I don't want to overemphasize someone like him because people like him are a dime a dozen. There's always going to be some academic who will do the bidding of a robber baron, of the rich. That is a tale as old as time. In every food industry in America, you can find some academic that's a hack for industry. I talk about one in my hog chapter. But Bork, he really undermined this Brandeis notion of monopoly, of this avoidance of monopoly. And that was, he created this phrase, consumer welfare standard, that basically helped usher in this new era of monopoly in America, where, as I mentioned earlier, if you can show that prices are lower for consumers, you can have a merger go through.
Which you can show it's, from pseudoscience anyway. Like you said, you can make the data show whatever you want.
Yeah, you have a U Chicago economist making $100 million doing this racket. Some of these economists make more doing this than they do being teaching at Ivy Leagues. It's incredibly lucrative. And let's be frank. When you have a tenure-named professor at an Ivy League saying, oh, blah, 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 versus an average person, the journalist, you know what I mean? They're selling their credentialism. And also, like, let's also be honest. When you're grappling with power, I mean, these are hard decisions to make. Should a company be merged or not? But this whole pseudoscience makes, you know what I mean? It pretends people are using science to determine, can Sprint buy T-Mobile? Me personally, and this might just be my New Deal Catholicism showing, is once I realized that Robert Bork, he remember when Nixon was firing everyone on that Friday Night Massacre over his tapes? Robert Bork, everyone was quitting. And when it got to Robert Bork, he was like, I will do it. I will do what you want. I want to but you have to nominate me for the Supreme Court. We found that out later after the tapes, you know, years later in archival. Once I found that out, I was like, oh, you are a morally bankrupt person. You are willing to undermine democracy for your personal benefit. You should be disregarded. Like, your whole literature, your whole viewpoint, anything you've done to me is not relevant. Mm-hmm. But he was. It wasn't until very recently, honestly, it was, I got coffee with Commissioner Kahn a few years ago, back when I was at Treasury. I just wrote a paper and I was shocked why I was seeing monopoly level profits in the agriculture sector. She wrote an article 10 years ago about chicken monopolies and the Obama administration failure to do anything on that front. And she's the one that kind of really told me this history. And that's why I think her appointment is so great, because she's kind of known as the neo-Brandeisian, where it's a return to the old framework of power of, we don't want concentrated power. I mean, a simple little thing, what I mean by that kind of theoretical thing is, Iowa, we have a rule in the books. We don't enforce it, but it's called a Packer ban. You cannot own an animal you slaughter. If you were to enforce that rule, you would break up Smithfield. Or sorry, it's called WH Group. Smithfield is actually owned by the WH Group of Shanghai. But they're the largest owner of hogs. They own like 1 in 4, 1 in 5 hogs. And they're also a butcher. If you enforce that rule, you break them up. I mean, it's that whole Glass-Steagall. I mean, that Glass-Steagall where commercial bank investing banks had to be separate. That's a very Brandeis framework of how do you put in very bright line rules to prevent concentrations of power? Because lawyers make their money when rules aren't bright lined.
This is key, because then you go into the Driscoll's chapter where they've kind of figured out how to diffuse the blame for any of like the worker welfare issues on the farms, right? Because what they've done is actually, you know, they don't own any of the farms, right? But they sell.
Isn't that incredible?
None of the organic berries in America. So we've definitely got a monopoly here. Let's talk about Driscoll's, their vertical and horizontal integration, and how that's kind of made them just to put their hands up, like they don't have any blame for you know, either because their prices are so low, right? Then the whole depression of what happens on the farms then ultimately should run up the chain, but they've been able to diffuse the blame.
Driscoll, that's my favorite little cocktail chatter, is they sell 1 in 3 berries in America, but they don't grow a single berry. I mean, Driscoll's is like a really good example of all these different things of a company that just kind of took all these brokenness and put them together to their benefit. I mean, these brothers that took over their family's company after their parents tragically died in an airplane crash in the 80s was they realized quickly the emergence of Walmart, that these super centers, grocery stores, these national grocery stores want one company to do 4 berries year round. So what they did is they basically view themselves more as like a Silicon Valley company, like an IP, or like a Nike, like a t-shirt company. Nike doesn't make anything it sells. It just contracts out the production. You're paying for the marketing when you buy a Nike t-shirt. That's how Driscoll's is.
Yeah.
What they do is they ship production globally. I mean, they grow berries on every continent except Antarctica and on the globe. And that's just based on, you know, because, you know, the one that grows berries, you only have that short little window. They do that, but then like you have this whole these two undercurrents to labor. I mean, that is when you move, you know, production to Baja California from greater Santa Cruz area, there's way less safeguards. I mean, a lot of these are indigenous people. They're basically modern day plantations. I mean, as a, someone doing this, it's really, really hard to go investigate that stuff. You're putting your personal safety at line. So that's usually when we see reporting come out of it, out of these areas. It's usually when something really, really bad happens. I mean, you see reporting of 12-year-olds, you know, working for $1 a day, picking stuff. How are you supposed to compete when someone's using child labor to produce, you know what I mean? In these, I'm not saying, I gotta be careful with liability here, but there's so much we don't know. It's just like a t-shirt. It's like those, it tragically, it feels like every few years there's some new triangle fire somewhere in Asia because of this model of production. When we shifted clothing manufacturing from the Carolinas offshore, we're seeing that in produce and Driscoll's. But Driscoll's, I mean, their brand image. I mean, they write op-eds with the former Democrat governor of California. I don't know. It is, and then there's a whole water issue in California. I mean, berries are incredibly water intensive. They only grow berries on the coast. There's not a lot of rainfall there, so I have to pull from the aquifers. A lot of their berry production in Baja is in an area that only gets 3 inches of rain. But I mean, as dry as Death Valley. So they had depleted the aquifers. They built their own desalinization plant in the ocean. They can afford it, but the people living there can't.
Yeah, I mean, how do we, so if this is clearly illegal, right? How do we start enforcing some of these laws?
I want to be careful with that because, I mean, when you're writing a book about robber barons, there's a reason why I have nearly 1,000 citations. I think I made it really clear when you read my Slaughtering Baron chapter, company called JBS, Brazilian meatpacker, largest meatpacker the world's ever seen. The ones that got reported last year that they were hiring 13-year-olds to work for Slaughterhouse, third shift. Breaking rules for a lot of these barons is a cost of doing business. USDA slaps their hand saying, don't do that, and they continue on. JBS admitted to bribing nearly 2,000 politicians, including a Manhattan apartment, to become a monopoly. And we let them keep their monopoly. Do you want to do that? That is where we are. I mean, that is so scary that the whole undercurrent of that chapter is Vilsack, of just how much he failed as Secretary of Agriculture. Companies will keep pushing the line. I mean, you're always going to have that bully, that person that will keep going until they're forced to stop. When you don't face consequences for your actions, you're just going to keep pushing it. And so who's at fault here? Is it going to be
so small that it's like, yeah, like you said, it's like a slap on the wrist, even though there's a consequence.
Yes. I mean, someone died in my manure digester on my dairy baron's farm. It's $10,000.
Right.
You know, these three children lost their father, and guess what? I mean, that where the person died, it's still a tour. And that is, that digester is talked about as if it's a solution for climate change. And people say that with a straight face when it's so clearly not. Like, that is the wildest thing got to me about the dairy chapter is there's so much gaslighting about, it's kind of like ethanol. I mean, like, there's no conversation to be had over, is ethanol good for the climate? It's not. Like, let's not even pretend it's a climate change solution. Digesters are the same way. I mean, it is wild. And also, sorry, this is my favorite little factoid about the dairy chapter. That whole area, that northwest part of Indiana where they have their operation, that's a former wetland. That's a former Everglades of the North, where Teddy Roosevelt used to go hunting. That should not be in production. I mean, it only dawned on me because I was driving around is I saw canals everywhere, and I've driven a lot of the Corn Belt. I have never seen canals around a cornfield before. And you're just like, what is going on here? And which led me to this, you know, it's a wetland that 95% of it's been drained, but it's like, oh, if we care about climate change, this wouldn't be in intensive row cropping production.
Yeah, it goes back to what you were talking about, breaking up the USDA, just kind of throwing it out, because what they're doing is trying to put little band-aids on some of these really broken systems. And their latest climate smart agriculture did that. It, you know, gave money to put in these methane digesters instead of actually putting the cows back on pasture. So it's like all these places just have the ability to lobby for what looks like change, right, in the right direction, but it's really just, it's not real structural change. It's actually just, you know, a little cosmetic change, and then the system.
Yeah. It's one of those, it's the story of Vilsack's career is pretending to care and not.
Right.
Is you want the press release, you want the hit, but you're not going to change anything. You want your cake and have it all too. It's one of those, and I mean, this might be like my dad's influence showing on me. People, they like to use big words to really hide what they're doing. Oh, digesters, manure. It's just like, once you like really boil this stuff down, it's not that complicated. And it's just mostly BS. Like, you know, first of all, cow and pasture, they're eating their own feed. You know what I mean? They're fertilizing their own feed. They're doing their own thing. When you stuff them in these metal sheds, you have to then use chemical fertilizers to grow the feed. So I know a lot of people know this already, but like me as a person who's not in dairy production, I just laugh because it's like, oh, so now we're using all these fossil fuels to grow their feed. But then when you pool their manure, you're actually creating methane gas that's not created when it decomposes on pasture. So you created your own problem, but then you're solving your own problem you created and calling that climate change. And then on top of it, we're drinking less milk, but our dairy consumption's up. It's because we're eating more ice cream and butter. And it's like, you literally have one branch of government saying, don't eat a lot of ice cream. And you're having another part of USDA saying, eat more ice cream. Like, it's one of those, like, the cojones where people can look you straight in the eye and say this. And in polite society, we're supposed to respect them. It's just like, I'm done with that. I'm really done with that. It's corrupt. And like, to me, what really bothers, and this really was ingrained in me with the Hog Grand chapter, is when people like Vilsack do that, they're just buying time to drag you out. They're going to outlast you. I mean, I saw that with the story of Hog. I mean, I opened with the Hog Baron, what happened to Iowa, my home state. How did the Hog family farm die? And what you'll see is politicians like Vilsack would be like, well, let's study it. Let's do a tax credit, whatever. And it's just like, you are not competing on the same playing field. They're going to outlast you. They have my hog, the industrial hog operators had Wall Street capital. And so, I mean, Vilsack oversaw the death of the hog family farmer as governor of Iowa. Then he oversaw the death of the dairy family farmer as, you know, secretary of agriculture. And it's just like, I'm over being polite. Like, oh, everyone kind of rolls their eyes when he talks about his solutions. It's like, no, you are. My grandkids are going to pay for your consequences. Like that is what really bothers me. It's like your inability to do anything because you want to probably be a lobbyist again because you already were a lobbyist before is like really detrimental to everyone because your personal greed. It's just the air of rampant selfishness. It's just like really what bothers me here.
Do you
and just a few people.
Because we've made this personal, do you think that they've fooled themselves into saying, well, this truly is efficient. We are supplying cheaper food to everybody. Do you think they really believe that or do you think they know better?
They really believe it. That is what I've seen in my time at Yale, my time being with these people. People will tell themselves whatever they need. No one wants to be the villain in their own story. Very few people will admit they're Martin Scorsese. You know what I mean? Like that. They're like, they want to think they can have it all. Yet, like, you can't make dumb money in America and pretend you're doing good. I'm in these spaces a lot, and I always just find it really fascinating to see the delusion. I mean, you also have a whole agribusiness media that perpetuates these narratives, you know? And I mean, so many of these publications, I don't want to name names. I have Google Alerts on all of them. I read a lot. I read thousands of clips, news articles for this book, and you see it. I mean, my own Hog Baron has his own spokesperson. They create their own narratives. And so I think they really do drink their own Kool-Aid.
And because the consequences aren't as high for them as, say, you know, bringing cheap food to everybody, even though they kind of just ignore the fact that it's not really cheap in the end, you know?
Yeah.
But the environmental consequences, those just take the back burner because you can't really delusion yourself out of those. I mean, they're so apparent.
Yeah, but like you just wall yourself off. I mean, my Hog Baron, he doesn't live where he built his empire. He lives in the only gated community in Iowa by the like over in West Des Moines. And then he has a home down in Naples, Florida on the coast. And he has a private jet that he flies back and forth between the two. Is he really seeing them? No. Is he doing site visits? I really doubt it. These people, they just don't live in the reality anymore. Hmm. And then you just have a whole ecosystem that licks them up and down. I mean, the hardest part about writing a type of book like this is then you kind of have, I call it aristocratic rot. A lot of the law firms in Des Moines, I mean, they're not working for, you know what I mean? A family farm of 50 cows. They're working for the Hog Baron. And so it's just, I mean, that's the weird thing about this moment I've had to personally grapple with myself is, you know, a lot of people are struggling to get by. You don't know what people have in loans, but you know, you have a lot of people complicit to the power and to the corruption here. I say that, but also like I've been very fortunate where that's usually a lot of my best sources come from. A lot of people, I mean, they're in these systems and they'll tell me, you know, they're just really sick of it. I mean, they don't like me. They're doing a job to pay for their family, but they're also repulsed of what it's become. I don't know. That's kind of like a weird way to answer that question.
Yeah, if I don't do it, someone else will. So if the
Or it's all
solution,
broken.
right. If we're talking about solutions needing to come from government, and yet that is where the barons have power. But you have a little glimmer of hope here with this change in the leadership at the FTC. But is this even practical?
Yes. I mean, I want to reconceptualize when we talk about the food system. It's not just about the farmer. You got to look at the whole food system, the grower, processor, picker, transporter, cooker, or the cook, the waiter. 1 in 10 Americans do this for a living. This whole farm bill, this modern coalition, is based in 1960s America, where food assistance was paired with the farm bill. And the dirty secret is these robber barons hollow out their voter membership. And suburbia America is not in that picture. Once you start talking about, I think politically, what we feed our children, what a home run politically. On top of it, the whole Republican world, you have, which, by the way, this rhetoric plays really well. I publish a lot in the American Conservative, about this stuff, because I really want to show how a new political coalition, bipartisan, can be formed around this stuff. This isn't like a red or blue, that kind of stuff. But I mean, even the Republican Party, I mean, they can't even pass their own farm bill because that whole Koch apparatus wants to gut. It's getting so expensive, this overproduction of the few grains, that they can't even stomach it. So you have that, where I think politically selling better food for your kids is great. The modern coalition of the farm bill is breaking down in front of us. Ethanol dying in front of us, which is going to like really make us rethink how we do a lot of grain production in the Midwest. But on a personal level, I just think it's so huge. I mean, if you could just get your local university, your local school, to start buying from family farms in your area, people doing it right, that's such a game changer. You know, you talk to anyone that does the farmer market circuit, it's not fun. You can get rained out, you know, but whereas like you get these contracts from institutional buyers, that's guaranteed money. I mean, I always go back and I talk about this with the farm bill. What we've seen happen in this Wall Street farm bill is, it used to be a farm would have multiple crops going on. That way, in case one market cratered, you had other thing. Well, now everyone's putting their chips in one thing. And I just go back to retirement. It'd be like, you know, putting all your retirement in one stock. You don't do that. You spread your assets around. And just by having growing different things, also selling different things, is better. It makes a family much more stable. That's the hope I have. And then things change fast. I mean, imagine if Francis, you know, Vilsack, you know, retires at the end of this term and, you know, becomes a lobbyist again. And all of a sudden Francis was named Secretary of Agriculture. That's a game changer. That's, you know what I mean? Moments like that can happen, but they don't just happen they don't happen on their own. People need to call for it. I mean, to be frank, part of the reason why I say this was when, after Biden won, you know, people, Democrat, lefty groups in DC start putting together a list of, hey, we have all these positions to fill. There's this whole government book called the Plum. I think it's called the Plum Book, where it lists all the government appointees. None of these groups are putting together a list for agriculture. I kept telling people, every state gets like 2 USDA appointees. These are good jobs. Those lists, and like, that's a conversation. I really want a lot of people listening to really think that way. I mean, if anyone part of organizations like, hey, let's put forward, hey, I live in Wisconsin, who would be the two people we really want to, you know, have local appointees for USDA, you know, for the state, or even like, who do we want for the Undersecretary of Nutrition, or GPSA is the one I really care about. But things like that. I mean, these are really important positions that no one's thinking about. And if you don't think about it, well, trust me, Cargill, my robber barons are.
So the big joke is, you know, what would you do if you were Vilsack? And the big joke is, well, it depends on how long I would want to stay as the Secretary of Agriculture, because, you know, the second you try to create a lot of change, they get rid of you. Do you feel like someone can really last in any of these positions if they're really trying to create structural change like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Leah Kahn really is a model here of, there's this Italian phrase, I have it actually hanging up on my door. I don't know how to say it in Italian, but it's called the politics of the artichoke. You can't be at war with everyone. you got to pick your opponent off one at a time. Lena is focusing on tech. You know,
explain,
I mean,
first of all, explain how what does that have to do with the artichoke?
Oh, how you eat it? Oh, sorry, how you eat an artichoke?
Oh,
you
oh.
Eat it one. Sorry.
Gotcha. Okay, now I'm with
no,
you.
That's fine. That's fine. No. My husband, my brain kind of bounces around. You know, you eat artichoke one leaf at a time, and so you pick off your opponents one at a time. The thing about agriculture is, I don't think I've seen it. I mean, part of my anger too with ILSEC is I've never seen an industry like meatpacking being a bigger pinata politically. I mean, the way they abuse their workers during COVID, it was like every month there's a new lawsuit over the price gouging. Ranchers, just all this. You have such a ripe political moment for reform. And also, Americans are primed for that. When we talk about monopoly, one of the first things they think about is meat monopolies, the meat trust, the jungle, Sinclair, Teddy Roosevelt. And it's just like, not only his inability not to do anything, the meat markets got more concentrated. So I think, also, by the way, most of these meat companies aren't even American. Like, that's the funny little part. Yeah. I think someone can go in there and make a lot of really substantial reform and actually be rewarded politically on both sides of the aisle. But you mean you can't just go out there declaring war on everyone. Focus. Let's do meatpacking and like build from there. Build on your victories. I mean, it's going to take, you got to have a few victories underneath your belt so the industry knows you're serious. You also, what gives me hope in a weird way too is this industry is so rotten. The corruption is so comical. Because I mean, they've been getting away with it for so long. I mean, you just hear these little, you know, behind the scenes, you hear these little stories, these little like, oh, these little shenanigans going on. I mean, checkoffs, my whole dairy chapter is really about checkoffs. Cause I think that's like the big, that really controls the conversation. And when you have nearly $1 billion, we don't even know how much money, by the way, are in checkoffs. It could be around $1 billion. For people out there listening, checkoffs are, you're forced to pay a tax into your commodity to advertise your commodity. Every farmer. Here's the thing, there's like 20 some of them. Most of them don't matter. There's like a popcorn one, you know, Christmas tree one. They're just like a $500,000 thing, what have you. Dairy is a $600 million entity. That's what ILSEC kind of was in between. I would argue, and I kind of make this point in my book, it used to be about advertising. It's really not anymore. They realized Got Milk wasn't driving dairy consumption. Instead, I believe that money is now being used to reinforce the business model of the barons, but also used to finance junk science like the manure digesters. Because they realize the climate change thing is going to be the weakness for industrial dairy. So might as well get ahead of the narrative. So if you have all this junk science saying, well, here's how we saw, oh, look at dairy's good for the climate. That's a lot better than a bunch of ads and magazines that are now dead saying Got Milk.
And is that transparent when they're collecting the tax?
No.
Otherwise, it's just used for marketing, right?
It's just used for marketing. Well, even dairy is my favorite little example because Congress mandated that every year the Secretary of Agriculture has to file a report to Congress saying how the dairy money is spent. By the way, these reports don't really have much information in them. They're not hard to do. ILSEC took 4 years. He didn't file them. Like, it took 3 or 4 years of people being like, where are they? These are like mandated. You are a dairy lobbyist. Don't you feel guilty? I mean, first of all, that shows you how
much power.
How much power, but also just like how blatant his, like, I'm trying to like, I gotta be careful. I don't want to say he's like not a good person, but like when Congress says you have to do something and you just don't do it.
Yeah.
And like you don't even like, especially when you were a former lobbyist of that space, you would think you would want to compensate for that. Like people assume you're doing their bidding. When you're just so overt about it, it's like kind of almost cartoonish. That's so the checkoff thing. But here's the thing, because there's no transparency, the corruption around is rampant. I just think you start putting attention on this, people will be really sickened by what they see. I really do think that. You see little stories here and there where some of the checkoff money is used to finance trips to Hawaii, what have you. I mean, I talk about in my Dairy Baron chapter, they'd created their own privately branded milk, Fairlife, that was used partly to, you know, buy checkoff dollars for their personal gain. I uncovered that even though they help run this dairy empire in Northwest Indiana, looks like they claim their residency as Puerto Rico at the Ritz-Carlton, because if you move to Puerto Rico mostly full-time, you don't pay capital income taxes. And it just so happens they just sold Fairlife to Coca-Cola for an undisclosed sum.
with all these legal loopholes.
I would say gray, but legal. Yeah, it's. I think someone, reformers who are empowered to reform, can make a lot of progress here because it's just so broken.
Yeah. I know you touched on this a little bit, but I don't think we've stressed it enough, just how it really monopolies and the consolidation of an industry really result in a race to the bottom in quality. And so maybe talk about that a little bit with some specific examples, because I feel like there's so much information to overcome, and cheap food for all is just such an easy one to like think that's what's happening if you don't touch the markets. And so how do we overcome that when we have so many facts and figures that are on our side, but it's just like this, your book is incredible and it's so much information there. You know, what is our like slogan? And, you know, and you mentioned that maybe it gets at people's hearts, and it's the quality of food. And so that's sat with me, and it's like, okay, maybe this is something that affects people personally, that now our food has such low quality. So if this is, and maybe you disagree, this isn't our, you know, one liner, but we need one. But if it is, how do we convince everybody that that's the case?
I don't even use the phrase cheap food. That's like another phrase, like small farms, I avoided in the book. Yeah. It's not true.
Yeah.
You look at per capita, what other countries spend, it's just not true. But that's like the phrase that always like irks me the most is feed the world. And it's like, we're not feeding the world. In Iowa, we're burning in our cars for no reason. So it's one of those things where, I mean, that's so much, but it takes, I mean, you have that whole apparatus saying these phrases over and over, where it's just kind of, you're being gaslit. Like, I mean, gaslit is a weird phrase to use now. It's kind of overused, but it's just like, that's just not reality.
Basically, because so much tax money is going in like Malta, and you make such a good case, it's like, we are subsidizing this. That's why it's not cheap.
My Walmart, it's just like, the world's richest family is how much subsidies goes into their workers, because they're not paying them a living wage. I mean, Walmart to me, when I actually started this book, Walmart wasn't the original plan. I was going to do Publix. It's like a Florida grocery store chain, because they helped finance January 6th. I was like, oh, that's an interesting narrative.
Interesting.
But then like once you, because I never thought of Walmart as a grocery store, even though I go to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've been to Walmart plenty of times to get groceries. But once I start looking, I'm like, oh, no. Walmart is everything. And not only is it everything, I've almost viewed it as like the king of the barons or the queen bee. It's just because it's like, its market power is profound. I mean, everyone talks about Amazon, but Walmart, I mean, the whole chapter is framed around Walmart and Amazon have been this epic battle for the last 5 years. And it's been centered in grocery. And I really think Walmart's winning. I use like the Godzilla versus Mothra kind of debate, and I kind of end that chapter of, well, we all kind of lose because they're, you know, what they step on underneath. But think about Walmart. I mean, Walmart kind of helped. Walmart's the creation of Walmart kind of creates a Driscoll, because what happens is when one company has so much market power. Which, by the way, I go into this history, but we used to have all these market protections between buyers and sellers of how they could sell. Hey, if you offer one size of something, you got to offer it to someone else. If you offer this bulk price, you got to offer it to someone else, all that kind of stuff. That all collapsed under Reagan, which allowed Walmart to basically become, you know, really concentrate power fast and then use its compounding power to compound its power even further and further. But then what happens is everyone else who isn't doing business with Walmart realizes, oh, you know, it's like the notion of big begets big, because they want to basically counter Walmart's power. I mean, you had it's hard to get all these grocery stores straight. Albertsons is buying Kroger or some kind of thing like that right now.
Yeah, that's
great. You had these. Yeah, and first of all, they each own like 20 brands. So like, you might not even, depending on where you live in America, not even heard of these, but you probably heard of one of their brands.
It's, and I list them all in the book. Yeah, so it's all the Safeways and the King Supers. These are the ones at City Markets. They're all one.
Yeah. I can't even, it's funny, I can keep my peanut butter monopoly straight, but I can't keep those straight. But they even said under the oath to Congress that, oh, part of the reason why they're merging is because Walmart. And like, to me, one of the things I loved researching this book was, I love going through these like little niche publications. And Walmart, that northwest corner of Arkansas, is just booming. The Wall Street Journal actually just did a big section on its housing market. It's just, you know, it's becoming the next Dallas. And it's becoming like the center of, like, you know, the vendors of America, like America's import business. I mean, I talk about the whole, it's one of the most unequal places to in America. That's a whole different conversation. But Walmart has this, and so I found the business publication that covers this part of Arkansas. And the whole business publication centered on talking about this little ecosystem. And that's where I found some of the most juicy nuggets, like something simple as on Snap Day, Walmart sees like a 3x increase in its Hot Pocket sales. So it knows before food stamps hit, it increases its Hot Pocket orders. But the thing that really showed me Walmart's power going through doing this research was Walmart has a rule with its suppliers that no more than 30% of its business can come from Walmart. And like, I didn't really get that at first, to be honest with you. I asked some people I know in the grocery industry, why would Walmart do that? And they go, Austin, it's for supply chain management. They realize they're such a vulture that if a company gets to sell more than 30% of their stuff to Walmart, it puts them at risk for going bankrupt. Because they basically, for most suppliers selling to Walmart, they sell at cost, it's a money loss, what have you. They need to basically sell 70% elsewhere to make up for Walmart, which, you know what I mean? Just skews the playing field more. And I just like, what a great demonstration of market power.
That one hit me really hard too. Because just like you, I was like, what? Why would they limit the amount that, you know, a supplier could give to just Walmart? And then it was like, oh, because their policies put them out of business and they don't want that to happen. That is a memorable story.
But, it isn't like,
go ahead.
I was going to say, I remember doing my research. They publicize what vendors are over the line. My peanut butter monopoly was, that company was over the line. I just like, that's funny. They're shaming them.
Well, I wondered if they framed it as, see, we support competition, or like some other way.
Well, I mean, that's, as some people might know, Walmart's making really aggressive vertical plays into beef slaughtering right now and milk production. You know, it has a milk plant in Indiana, now just announced it's building one in southern Georgia. And part of what I'm hearing from people in these areas is Walmart, the failure of USDA to do anything to police these really broken markets is Walmart's now doing plays into these spaces. It doesn't want to do a full vertical play like Costco did with chicken in Nebraska, where Costco basically has its own supply chain of chicken. Walmart's doing little, they call them beachheads, where it just wants a little insight to the cost structure of milk production. So that way, when it negotiates with other milk producers, it can be like, no, this is what it really is. Like, you can't gouge us. But that's where we are. The fact that Walmart is doing the policing of these broken markets because USDA failed to do it is funny.
Yeah, I was really stricken by that plus one policy too that you described, where it's like every year, every brand for every product has to either lower their price by a certain percentage or increase the quality. It's like, how much can you increase the quality of a Hot Pocket? So therefore, they're going to have to lower their price, right?
Yeah. It's so much of this too is just personal things. I've been kind of pondering for a while. I mean, you know, because I've been working on this book for 5 years, I'll write a chapter, put it down, think about it. And I really just got into estate sales a few years ago. And it's just, I got so sick of the quality when I shop. And it was just like, oh, and then it was Stacy Mitchell. When I was doing research for this book, I read her book on Walmart, came out like 10, 15 years ago. She co-runs the Institute for Local and Self-Reliance up in Portland, Maine. And she wrote this article about kind of getting at that plus one. What that means is it's just a race to the bottom in terms of quality. And then because you're seeing these other, you know, massive consolidation elsewhere, there's not really competition among these other for quality. Walmart doesn't, especially like when you see a lot of the stagnation of American incomes, in part because people aren't making their money because of these robber barons. You know, sure, people want to buy a better product, but they're also barely getting by. So they're going to buy, you know, a 99-cent spatula. That's not going to last long because, hey, a $10 spatula is what have you.
And for anybody who's thinking, great, lower prices, they're pushing people to lower prices, right? It actually the more consolidation that ends up happening, it actually ends up just feeding the pockets of the CEOs, right? They actually don't really lower the prices for the consumer. They lower the prices for Walmart, right? But it doesn't always transfer to the consumers.
No, I think my favorite, and I like to kind of view them as a little shady. There's this, Obama's a head of his economic council. His name is forgetting me right now. He's now a professor of econ at Harvard. He wrote a paper before he was appointed to the Obama administration saying the progressive case for Walmart. And basically his whole thing was, oh, we just need to do more subsidies. And it's just like, first of all, not discloses his family has a real estate company who does business with Walmart or has done business with Walmart. So it's just like one of those like, okay, let's just put that over there. But two, it's like, why should we have massive subsidies for the world's richest family? They make, you know, like, if you're not viable, like a lot of these programs were created for people when they were in dire needs, like moment. Now they're for perpetual programs. You know what I mean? You shouldn't be working a full-time job and require food assistance, but that's where we are. It's a welfare subsidy for the barons because they don't want to pay them their living wage. And, you know, I document in the book, anytime there's labor union activity at Walmart, it turns out they need to shut the Walmart store down for plumbing issues.
That's one of my favorite walkaways from this, actually. And it's like a quote that you said something about how that they're not self-made, these barons, that the system made them.
Yes.
Right? So these are systemic changes that we really need. And
yeah. We can unmake them. That is like, I mean, I think right after that line is we can choose to unmake them. It okay. doesn't have to be this way. Like these barons can only be barons because of the massive subsidies. I mean, let's go Hawks. If you were to enforce air regulations and water regulations on them, the model is probably not economically viable. If we even force them to manage their manure like we do human beings, they're probably not economically viable. I mean, the dairy baron, that operation alone produces as much manure as the city of Austin, Texas.
And the public resources that they're using to do that, right?
Yeah, and it's just like
water or, you know, even the tax breaks and all that stuff. It's just weird. The system is supporting this and allowing them to do it. So, but I think it goes beyond allowing, supporting.
Corrupting. I mean, that goes back to the Brandeis, is when you have that much money. I mean, I talk about this whole book kind of came about because I literally was in a bar in Iowa, and it was a 2018 governor's race in Iowa. And a buddy told me the story of how the largest Republican donor in Iowa was my hog baron. Mm. And how, I mean, what caught my eye was he had his own, my buddy told me he has his own private jet, and it's rumored to have the phrase, when pigs fly on it. Which in my head is like, that's a good story. Let me see what's going on here, which, you know, led me to kind of really grapple with a lot of this stuff. And I mean, I should also say I wrote this book. I mean, I come from Iowa. I mean, the what happened to Iowa in my lifetime is profound. I mean, I opened with this vignette of like, I mean, I remember driving around as a child seeing cows and pigs. We play games with the cows driving up to the Wisconsin Dells. They're gone. You know, it doesn't happen overnight, but it's just slowly. And like, you see that in conversation with people. Because it's not just like, it's not. My mom loved her business. It was her passion. I mean, that was something she really wanted. It was such a hallmark. But, you know, it was part of our family for like 5, 10 years. And when we eventually, you know, we never lost money on, but we weren't making a lot. And we eventually closed. You know, it was hard. It's never easy when you lose a business. But a family farm is different because a lot of times you have your family legacy, you have all that. And on top of it, what I realize with a lot of people when you talk with people is a lot of people will blame themselves or internalize it without realizing, no, you were designed to fail. You were running uphill. You ran uphill really long, much longer than they intended. I mean, I open with that story in the Hawk chapter of the destruction of the family farm in Iowa was first thought out in a report commissioned by a DC think tank or consultant for a chamber of commerce type organization in Iowa. Like this was structural and systematic by corporate interest because, you know, what happened was North Carolina deregulated hogs, which was, by the way, it was a politician who did it. He did it in the poor black area He did this awful model production. And then instead of having USDA step in saying, no, don't do that, North Carolina, you're cutting all these corners, I was like, well, we're not going to lose number one status. We will race you further to the bottom. And off we go.
Yeah, your mom's story, I mean, even working hard on Sundays as a family and then talking about how much she gave to local causes and how when local businesses go away, a lot of that local giving disappears too. I mean, these are really personal stories, and I think that's probably the best route. And incredibly to you know, making people realize that we need this type of change, but we're losing that battle too. I mean, you talked about how Trump targeted these communities that have disintegrated and then has the, you know, rhetoric to say, I see you and we will bring that back, bring livelihood back to your town. Is any of that in his policies? Is the reality there, or is it just a story? Is it just, you know, he's good at convincing people that that's what he's going to do? Is there anything to show that that's what ends up happening?
No, I mean, but like the thing that keep in mind what you just said is he offered a positive vision, or he offered some sort of vision. I think the failure of the Vilsack types is they stifled out a vision on like a positive vision for rural America. What is Vilsack's vision for rural America? Digesters. I just remember I had this conversation. Former Tom Harkin, former senator, Democrat senator of Iowa. I used to always do when I was first learning about the Farm Bill. We do his old ag economist. We would do lunch once a month, and I would read reports. We would talk, and she arranged for me to meet with the head of the Farm Bureau of Iowa. And I just remember him. We had a conversation for a few hours, him telling me the future of Iowa is 7 towns and a bunch of driverless tractors. He's not wrong. Anytime corn goes up, booms, all the old farm homes come down in Iowa. The barns come down, more corn is planted. Trees are yanked up, more corn is planted. And honestly, most of these fancy combines anymore drive themselves. That's what that model, that framework will push towards. That's why they're trying to put ethanol in airplanes right now. That's like their new buzzword. That's not a positive vision, but also like... Who's excited about that? If you live in urban America, rural America, whatever.
Yeah.
That's not, to me, that's why I say, I love that phrase, animals back on land. It's simple. It's positive. It's a jobs program, my kind of joke. But like, I really do think, my husband's kind of annoyed. When we travel, I love seeing, like, I just love seeing different grocery stores, agriculture markets, what have you. And I like made him, like my big thing was for our honeymoon, I want to go to Italy. I'd never been to Europe. I wanted to see a food system that worked. And what I realized is like, oh, like Iowa could be the Italy of North America. Has the world's best soil. These little towns have beautiful brick downtowns. People like that. People, you see people doing it already. I mean, the driftless, I love talking about the driftless. It's one of my favorite parts in America. I wrote a chunk of the book up there. I saw family up there. And it's just like, I mean, it's a lot of these places are struggling. They're not what they used to be. But they're examples of what the system could be. I mean, there's people that get up every day and show that a different model is possible. And that's my goal is there are people out there doing it right. How do we not only empower them so they can thrive, create more people like them? How do we put them in positions of power so we can push out the Vilsack and put those people in positions of power? That's the future I want. I think that's the future most Americans want. Yeah. And like that is as weird as like kind of dark this book is I really, I'm a big believer, like usually the way American, there's that old Churchill quote where Americans like, things kind of almost, sorry, I'm not going to say it right. Things basically have to break for us to do the right thing. Mm. I think we're at one of those moments. And like, that's why the ethanol thing I think is so important is that model of overproducing grains is breaking in front of us. The question is, what are we going to do? Are we going to put ethanol in planes? Or are we going to put animals back on the land?
Hmm. Can I add two words to our mm-hmm. beautiful vision that we're going to give the world to make this happen?
Animals, yeah, yeah.
And people back on the land.
It's a lot of people. That's the beauty of like being a farmer or like people like my mom. A lot of people just want to be their own boss. Hmm. No one wants to be another low-wage worker in the Walmart empire.
Yeah.
They want to be able to command their own schedule. Like a lot of people crave that. And a sense of dignity and meaning and kind of, a lot of people are doing jobs they just don't feel rewarded in right now. And that is something, you're not being your whole self.
Good. I like where this has gone because there's a lot of things to be upset and enraged by. A lot of facts in the book, but we have I didn't even realize that that's where it would end up. Is that Trump's actually done a really good job at painting a picture to people who have been had hardship from all of these policies, and we need to do a better job at that. And you know, this isn't divisive, like you said. We've gone after Vilsack just as much, if not more. So yeah, I think we can come together around this. I think there's a lot of commonality, and it's around bringing beauty and taste. And you know, I think there's a quote in your book somewhere about Alice's water vision of a what is it, a delicious future,
delicious revolution. Like I added that line after Marble Seed. I spoke at Marble Seed last year, and you just, so much to me, public speaking is like stand-up comedy. You're trying new rhetoric, you're seeing how stuff lands with people. And what I realize at this moment right now is people want that positive vision. They want that Francis Dickey. They want that food system.
Yeah,
it tastes better. It's better on the eye when you drive by it. It's what I love about Alice's phrase, that delicious revolution, is it just takes the temperature down. Yeah. You know, I actually was very fortunate. I had dinner with her a week or two ago. I was out there for a wedding, and she told me her political secret is she always serves a big meal before she does her ask, because it's just like, when you have a good meal, you're just happy. Like at my wedding, we did that. We purposely had only organic Iowa food, only from the state of Iowa, pasture. My mom's one of 12. I have a big Irish Catholic family. And the amount of Iowans came up to me and told me how good my pork was hilarious.
I love it. Well, good. It's so great to find another ally in this. I'm afraid it's going to have to be a battle. Any revolution is, right? So, but framing it in a sense of hope and a better future. It's so great to meet you. Tell everybody how to find this book and when.
Yeah. So I encourage anyone, go to your local bookstore, bookstore's website. My book comes out March 26th. It is called Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. I would really appreciate it if you pre-order. I am a first-time author, and just kind of be on theme. There's a lot of consolidation in the book space. So any, like, just pre-ordering really helps get this book out there. It shows bookstores that people care. Take a look at it. I mean, I would love to hear what your listeners think is, who's their favorite Baron. That's like one of my, I truly love asking that question, because there's not I thought one Baron would be the obvious answer, and there's not. Like, everyone has a different Baron. And it's always fascinating to hear, well, why that Baron? So, yeah, I mean, reach out to me after your...
Be less great, all your Barons that didn't make it.
oh, trust me, I would love, if I could add Baron. I love this framework. There's a few Barons I'm toying with already. It's weird. I love the research part, but to me, research is just step one. Step two is letting people know, proselytizing, getting the word out, and then, you know, pushing for that change.
Thank you, Austin.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Real Organic Podcast. Our movement is growing because you are subscribing and sharing these podcasts with your friends. Keep it up and leave us a rating and a review as well. You can find a video version of this interview at our newly designed website, realorganicproject.org, or by following us on our YouTube channel. And you can join us every Tuesday for a new episode featuring voices from the organic movement. See you next time.